Welcome to the Productivity Mastery Podcast, presented to you by myself, Stoyan Yankov, productivity and performance coach, keynote and TEDx speaker, and co-author of the Perform Methodology, and the book Perform, the Unsexy Truth About Startup Success. Join me on a journey to discover what some of the world's leading professionals do to be more productive, create peak performing teams, and build successful global companies. New episodes weekly. And now, enjoy today's episode. Happy New Year, everybody. Welcome to the first episode of Productivity Mastery. And it's going to be a special one because I do have a special guest with me today, at the beginning of 2023. My guest has an incredible journey, incredible story. I'm excited to unveil this story. He was born in, I hope I pronounced it well, Guyana, a small country in South America. His parents immigrated to Canada, but it happened when he was only 2 weeks old. At the age of five, him and his elder sister at the time, they had to take a plane and fly to Canada only with their clothes on. And I love one of the quotes in his book is that he's mentioning at the time of his childhood, the family was as poor as potatoes. So, and you probably wouldn't believe who's the person that's in front of me today, but Dr. Ivan Joseph is the Vice President Student Affairs of Wilfrid Walfrid University, known for its exceptional student experience. His TEDx talk has been seen by more than 26 million people. He's achieved multiple achievements and successes professionally. He's a best-selling author. He's one of the top experts in self-confidence and high performance in the world. He's a best-selling author of the book, You Got This. He's a family person with three kids, as I understand. And he is a one handsome man. Welcome to the show, Ivan.
You did your homework. Thank you for that lovely introduction. I appreciate the kind words.
Ivan, talk to me about the beginnings. What was it like just growing up in the first 5 years? Do you even remember anything? And then you moved to Canada. What do you remember for these first years?
Yeah. So, you know, growing up in Guyana, South America, it's interesting. I don't have a lot of memories, you know. You know, Guyana is what today we would call an emerging economy or emerging country. Back in those days, you called it a third world country. But, you know, there's a lot of, you know, the British left Guyana. There was a lot of colonial rule. And when they left, there was two factions, the Indians and the Blacks. And those two factions, they would war and they would fight and they would, you know, for political unrest. And so my memory, because I'm half Black and half Indian, you know, is one of just a little bit of steel drums. I can remember listening. I can remember bathing in the river. You know, it's not one of like, oh, wow. I remember walking to school. I remember the heat. I remember just a lot and lot of, like, I'll say, chaos. Because, you know, when your parents have left to try and create a better world, I was bounced from auntie to uncle to grandparent to relative. But my story is no different than any other immigrant story, right? Parents make sacrifices, do what they need to do in order to leave and find and create a better place for you. And they sent for us years later.
It reminds me, we visited an exceptional guy called Mansuk Patel in Wales, and his family, he's Indian. They were living in Kenya. And when they moved to the UK, and he was still a kid, and he remembers, the first thing he was surprised about was that, why is nobody running to school? Why is not somebody, people not running to the grocery shop? Everybody's walking or driving. Nobody's running. So it's very interesting to discover where we're coming from. But then also the interesting part is the development. And I wonder, you've been teaching self-confidence. And again, your TEDx talk is why we're here today. I listened to this talk probably 2014. I sent it to so many people before we had a chance to meet. and it's one of my favorite TEDx talks ever. And you've been teaching self-confidence, but I wonder, people look at you today, I would imagine they're like, this guy has it all figured out. He's so confident. He knows it all. When did you start developing the skill of self-confidence? Was it in the early years? And how did it start?
Well, let me first, like as a lawyer would say, disabuse you of the notion that I am full of self-confidence. You know, that talk came out when I was 38 years old. And, you know, I just got my new role as a director of athletics. And clearly, you know, that talk was resonating for me, is the reason I shared it, because I was not confident and I still struggle with it. So I want people to know, just because you have it doesn't mean it's there forever. It always goes away. But let's go back to what you first started. Excuse me for a second. You know, you kind of alluded to it, but I first came across this whole thing about self-confidence when I realized that I had lots of fear and doubt. I was like, I didn't believe in myself. I saw it, and really where it hit me, where I started noticing or calling it self-confidence, was when my girlfriend, who's now my wife, came to see me play college soccer. And she saw me play in the summer, and I was this beast. I was athletic. I was going all over the place. I was scoring goals. She's like, wow, you're the best player. And then she saw me play in college, and she's like, whoa, what happened to you? And this coach, who had been very critical and just really hard on people, he had taken the magic out of me, the thing that made me special. And I had become a shell, the husk and a seed, right, of who I was. And she's like, oh my gosh, what happened to you? This is not the guy I saw in the summer. You told me that this coach doesn't have any credentials, have any licenses, any knowledge. How have you let him make you this person? And she said something really important to me, which was, why are you letting this man define you? Why are you giving your power away to him? And she was right. And I didn't know it at the time. And that's when I was like, whoa, yeah, I was doing this to myself. Yes, this person was critical, but I was letting his behavior, his expectations of me, change how I was looking at myself. That's when I made the theoretical switch to say, I want to study this. But if you want to go back even before, as I said, I am the son of immigrants. And anybody who's an immigrant will know that there's a mantra that's put into them. Work twice as hard, right? Be better, be better, be better. You show up with a B, why not an A? You come second in the race, why not a first? And what happens by those parents driving you to be exceptional and excellence, which is something you need, you're never quite good enough. You never, ever make the standard. And this is not, you know, pity me, shame on my parents. You know, this is the story. This is, our parents are strong people. They only wanted the best of us. But that nature of the, either you could say it's the Caribbean, it's the Europe, Eastern European, you know, you could find it in the Polish family, the Serbian family, the Black family. We're all the same, right? Work better. This is not good enough. More, more, more. And eventually that tears away at you. You feel like you could never make anyone happy. And that infuses doubt in everything you do.
Do you feel like it's still a driving force for you to achieve more and be better? This kind of early beginnings of your family, kind of having this mindset of you got to do more.
Absolutely. You know, and I'm a psychologist by nature, but there's definitely, those things are rooted in you. You know, you want to make your parents proud. You want to make everybody else proud. You want to make your community proud. And there's some danger in that, right? And I'm it's not healthy always to continue to always push, because you have to stop and savor the moment. You know, when we talk about hope and optimism and happiness, if you're constantly just trying to get to the next level and you haven't taken a moment to pause and reflect, then you're always tired, then you're always worn out, then you're always unhappy. And that lack of contentment will lead to a thing that we study in sports psychologists that's called maladaptive perfectionism. That's a whole nother topic in itself. So, but you know, a short answer to it is yes, my self-doubt is grounded in the fact that I want to make sure that I'm achieving enough that people that raised me will be proud of the sacrifices they made for me.
I love it. Ivan, I talk to a lot of people, and as you know, we are to some extent in the same industry, working with a lot of people. I have a chance to to talk to, consult, coach many people. And many of the people I meet initially, everybody looks confident on the surface. Yeah. But when they start talking and sharing and you have the real conversation, majority of them are struggling in one way or another, not feeling good enough, having insecurities, not being confident. I love that your TED Talk and the subtitle of your book is about the skill of self-confidence. Could you maybe share some general pointers on, if it's a skill, what are some of the core things we should look into so we can develop this skill?
Yes. And I'm glad you mentioned that, Stoyan, because a lot of people think you're born with confidence. Oh, I've got it or I don't. Like, you know, it's like either I'm going to be 6 feet tall or I'm not going to be. I'm either going to be really fast or not. No, confidence is a skill, which means it's something you can acquire. And it means it's something that, you know, when you can acquire a skill, just like any skill, it can also leave you. It can get rusty. It can fall away if you don't continue to hone and practice it. So let's make sure we're all on the same definition when we talk about confidence before we talk about the skill of it and how we own it. The genuine belief in your ability to accomplish the task at hand. Genuine belief, not like, oh man, you know, I can fly a plane because I saw it on television. You know, I don't know if that's genuine belief. You know, the genuine belief only comes from repetition, repetition, repetition. So how do you get that skill, right? You can't just wake up, I'm confident, yes, woohoo. No, genuine. So what are you going to do over and over and over so that that skill becomes automatic? When we talk about Gladwell, if you watch my 10,000 hour rule or you watch my TED Talk, he talks about the 10,000 hour rule. Right, I don't know if it's 10,000 hours. It might be 5,000, it might be 3,000. But it's when you can do things without thinking about them. When you can do things without thinking about them, then you don't get to worry about them. In the world of sports psychology, we call this the ability to focus on a thing so it becomes routine and ordinary, right? You don't want to attend to a novel task. You want the task to be routine and ordinary. And so that's really important for that. Number two, right, after you get past repetition, 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 it's what you tell yourself, right? How many times have you told, oh, I wish I was skinnier. Oh, I wish I was smarter. Oh, I'm not good enough. I can't do that. How many times have you been in a classroom? Oh, don't pick me, teacher. Don't pick me, teacher. Don't pick me, teacher. I don't know, right? That negative talk, it takes away the magic in you. If I was to hook you up to a machine and look at your brain waves and look at your stress levels, when you allow negative self-talk to come into your head, negative chemicals react, the brain changes, all of that stuff. Watch high-performing athletes. When they make a mistake, you'll see them clap. You'll see them point. You'll see them take a deep breath. Why? That's their trigger. Stop it, the negative talk, and replace it with a positive talk. So we talked about repetition, repetition. We talked about stopping the negative talk, whatever this cue might be, a physical step to stop it. And then replace it with affirmations. If you watch my TED Talk, you'll hear, I am the captain of my ship and the master of my fate. I can learn anything. Nobody outworks me. A good friend of mine does one, says, I can do hard things. We don't think about these positive affirmations. Instead, what we think is like, oh, I can't do it. Oh, I'm no good. Stop it. Right? Affirmations. But here's the science behind affirmations. People think, oh, this is something from Oprah Winfrey. This is like the Hallmark Channel. This isn't anything. Let me give you the science. Lou Bromowski from Harvard, 2006, right? Three affirmations a day if you're in the creative world. It's something, don't quote me on the numbers, but something like 17% or more greater productivity, right? And if you're in the world of complex problem solving, analytics, logistics, diagnostics, right? You got to find the needle in the haystack, or you're a mechanic. What's this clunking noise? I don't understand. Or you got this complex problem strategy at work. I got to like move all these different HR pieces, make this work. Three affirmations a day, you're 25 to 29% faster to solve complex problems. Now, here's the people for you got a high performance talk. I imagine you got a lot of business people on this talk. Revenue generation, sales, three affirmations a day, over 30% increase in sales. What you tell yourself you become, right? And I'm not saying I can fly or I'm going to be a billionaire, but you notice my affirmations, I can do anything. Nobody outworks me. I'm the captain of my ship. Things that I remind myself when things go easy and I want to like, oh man, I'm going to quit. things are too hard and not going easy. Stop it. I can learn anything, right? I would encourage the folks that are listening on this to really take affirmations and just think about which ones, you know, they can write. I've got lots more, but I'll stop there at three and let you decide if you want me to share any more or ask any questions.
I love it. That I wonder now, I want to go really practical and great and easy, right? When do you do these affirmations, or from your experience, like, is it in the morning, in the evening? Do you have like these 5 minutes I'm going to talk about that? Do you do it in a specific tone of voice and physiology so yeah. It hits you even stronger? How do you do it?
So good question. So first off, I'll write my affirmations and I'll put them by my computer monitor, or I'll put them by my mirror when I'm brushing my teeth, right? Or I've got them right here by my visor, you know, like I want them there. Just, oh, I see them, you know, and they become, oh, you know how you have a poster up or something? I want them there. I don't use them all the time, like every day is part of my routine. But when I first was getting there, when I was down and out, I had to make it a part of my routine. So the thing is with affirmations is you'll go to the well different times, different ways. So when I first took over my job as a director of athletics, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I don't know what to do. I don't know how I'm doing this. Stop it. You got this, right? So then they become automatic. But you can't go automatic if you haven't put them down and you haven't trained them. What are your go-to? I'm the captain of my ship and the master of my fate. Yeah, I got this, right? So they become automatic. But they don't become automatic if you haven't put them in places and put them someplace where you're doing it. Now, you know who you are. So everybody's a little different. I've got some of my friends who do their affirmations every day before they go to bed, and they wake up, it's the first thing they do in the morning. I got them here, I got them here. I'm just going to remind myself, man, Dr. J, you're looking good today, man. You're a handsome fellow. Away I go, a bounce in my step, a song in my heart.
Yeah, I feel like people are listening to this kind of podcast and reading books, and they want to find the magic pill that is going to solve all my problems. If I do this one thing, it's going to solve all my problems. And it's like, well, maybe you have to do something for a certain period of time, and maybe you need to do not just one thing, but you got to look at it holistically, right? Yes. Like, okay, affirmations could work, but looking at you right now, you're in a good shape, right? Like you're probably exercising, eating well, sleeping well, positive affirmations, reading books, being surrounded by amazing people. In the book, you mentioned this phrase, the importance of mental development. And I want you to elaborate, because I forgot to mention, but some people probably don't know, you've been a national champion in mm-hmm. as what you Americans call soccer, and we call it football here in Europe. But I wonder, as I understood, it wasn't a winning team when you took the job. What really made the difference? Like, now that you can reflect backwards, what did you do to transform the culture? Was it the selection of the team? Was it the practices, the mindset? What made the difference?
Well, 101 things. So, but I'll start with the ones that are probably the most critical, right? A team and an individual to become high performing must have a clear sense of purpose. This is who we are. This is what we're about. This is our North Star. An organization has to have a clear sense of purpose. I mean, when they do, then they attract individuals with the same alignment. And this is the thing, is that when there's not alignment, that's when dysfunction and conflict happens. When there is alignment with that North Star, that clear sense of purpose, profits go up, happiness goes up, retention goes up, sick days go down, conflict goes down. You know what I mean? You ever had those people? That's not in my job description. That wasn't why you brought me here. Clarity of purpose, lack of clarity of purpose is the issue. Steve Jobs, put a ding in the universe. Skype, be disruptive in the pursuit of change. South Lake Hospital, a hospital where I am, give a damn, right? Thing is, organizations spend all this time with these fancy mission statements and vision statement and value statement that people don't know, they can't understand. I promise to give my value and grow the X percent by this and the market share of blah, blah, blah. No, a clear purpose makes the hair on your neck stand up. It says, yeah, I get that. Give a damn. Okay, right? You know, my clarity of purpose, I'm an educator first and foremost. People think, oh, you build teams. You build. No, I create teachable moments. I'm a teacher. And so when we think about this, right? The most important thing you can do when building a high performance culture is, this is who we are and what we're about. This is our North Star. When things are noisy, this is who we are and what we're about, right? That's the number one thing before I do anything, because that's about your talent. That's about your people. Only then do I go then to the next most important thing, which is this thing called cohesion. How well we stick together, how well we're connected to each other, how well we feel like we matter and we belong. I'm going to share with your readers a story about a Wall Street Journal study. Do I have time to share it?
Absolutely. And I love studies, okay. So let's go.
So they looked at this. They looked at the NBA teams. They said, let's try and figure out who's going to most likely win the championship. And of course, there's a professional team. They said, well, the team that has the biggest salary. Nope. Okay, then the team that has the most number one draft picks. Nope. Okay, then the team with the most all-stars. Nope. The team with the biggest college stars. No. You know what it was? The team with the most fist bumps, high fives, butt taps, chest bumps, gestures of love and affection. They called this cohesion. The team that felt like they were connected to each other was the team most likely to win the championship. What does that tell you? When we feel connected to each other, when we feel like we matter and we belong, when we feel loved and appreciated, wow. The problem is our workplaces, especially in COVID, have become virtual. Or in times of efficiency, we've gone away from the lunchroom and potluck suppers and team baseball leagues and small talk and bars and all these things, just about the work, just about the work, just about the work. And we've lost that sense of, hey, when Stoyan shows up to work, if his hair is all over the place, that means he hasn't had time to do his routine. He's probably in a bad mood. Or if Ivan shows up with two coffees in the morning, hells to the no, you don't want to leave him. That means he feels like he's jacking up for a caffeine day, right? Or you know what, here's Graham, and his grandma's not doing well. You got to give him some time. We need to know the little tells of each other, the little secrets, the little nuances about how to stroke somebody to get the best out of them, how to speak harsh to somebody to get the best out of them, how to love somebody to get the best of them. What do each of us need in order to bring out the best in us? That also folds right into not just high performance, but into confidence and excellence.
Yeah, we had a guest on the podcast, and I remember her name is Ellie Gosheva. She shared when I speak to her about leadership, that leadership should be individualized. You can't lead your team, every person, every member from the team the same way, because that's your leadership style. Yeah. And also reminds me of the time you were leading the team. And I wonder, did you have to personalize your approach? And now if you look backwards, did you do any mistakes in terms of, let's say, prioritizing players that are not coachable, and or anything else that you can now reflect and say, well, I could do it better next time?
Oh, for sure. You know, here's the deal. It took me 10 years with my first team to reach a national championship. 10 years. And in 10 years, we became number one and won the championship. The next time I changed schools, I did it in 3 years. So lots of lessons, lots of mistakes along the way, right? You know, I'll give you a perfect example. The first time I took talent over teamwork, right? Talent, let's get the most talent. I had this player from Trinidad that was an Olympian, this player from Argentina that played at the World Cup, this player that played at Valencia, Spain. I had all these different languages. I'm like, just put them together. And it was the most miserable experience of my life. And as I tried to rein that team in, as I tried to get them in, they didn't have respect for me. They didn't think I was good enough. And all 8 of those players left the team, 8 really great stars. And the next year we had my first and only losing season ever as a coach. And those freshmen that stood together, though, I learned my lesson. By the time those first year players were seniors, we won a national championship. The team that lost 8-0 and 11-0 as freshmen, I took the lessons I learned, where I sacrificed character and integrity and putting your others first over talent. And we won the championship and we changed our lives. And I say that because a lot of times we'll prioritize efficiency, or we'll prioritize profit or operational excellence in terms of systems over people. And while that might get the job done in the short term, it doesn't lead to long-term sustainable excellence and growth. I always treat everybody differently. you'll hear me talk about fairly, not equally, right? Because if we treat everybody equally, but if we treat everybody fairly, then that's different.
What does that mean, though?
So let me give you an example. Let's say, Stoyan, you come from a very affluent family, right? Your dad's a billionaire in the oil industry. And, you know, somebody else on your team is first generation. They can barely make, you know, they're on scholarship. And we've got a rule as a soccer program, and we just broke it. You're late. And the rule is everybody pays $100. That's equal rule. That's an equal rule if you're late. Stoyan, you're going to pay $100 without even thinking about it. You're like, okay, here you go. And this person here that comes from a different family is going to take $100. Oh my God, that's the money that I feed my family for a month. It's equal, but is it fair, right? Is it the same punishment and sanction? Is it the same opportunity? When we think about that, we think about systemic challenges that face people. Here's an example of equal and not fair. We know for a fact that women in business don't get the same opportunities for promotion and growth. And so if I have one woman in a final pool to get a job, they're not going to get the job. But if I make a rule that says, I want you to have two or more women in the final pool of five to get a job, then I'm 79 times more likely to hire a woman just by putting two in a pool of five. That's the difference, right? Those are the things that we have to look at, systems that operate that keep certain groups or certain people down or individuals. And how do we break those systems to make people have an equal opportunity to have excellence and progress through your organization?
Yes, and at the same time, right, when things are fair, I might be coming, and I'm not, but I might be coming from this billion-dollar family, but if I'm late, I'm late, right? Yeah. So I'll get the same punishment as everybody else, because that's fair treatment.
Yes.
And I wonder, because we're talking about high-performance teams as well, one, using metaphors from sports teams, but also many of these, I mean, businesses are driven by people.
Yeah.
How do we, Ivan? You've been attracting athletes. You've been hiring people. You've been coaching and supporting companies. How do we get the right people on board? And what I mean by that is, often you can kind of evaluate people's experience, right? Like, yeah, they have this skill. They worked 5 years as an engineer, so you can kind of get the skill. But how do we get the mindset?
Yeah.
How do we get this person is going to really fit the culture we're part of?
Yeah. And let me be quite clear. If I had figured this out and I got it right, then I would be a billionaire. So I don't have the right answer, but I have a answer, right? I think this is, you'll hear me use this term, recruiting on the front end, right? Recruiting on the front end means you show all your warts and all your wrinkles and all the things that are wrong with you or the organization up front. So you only attract the people who really want to be a part of that, right? I'll give you a sport analogy, and I'll give you a business analogy so you get it. Because what happens if you don't show all your things that are broken and dysfunctional and this, then you don't attract people who want to roll up their sleeves and really want to buy into that. You'll attract people who like, yeah, but they're always looking over there where the grass is always greener. Equally as important is when you're being recruited, you show everybody exactly who you are and what you're about, because you want somebody who wants you as you are, not something like you're trying to pretend to be, because that's not sustainable. So here's an example in the sport world. I coached in a soccer place where there was no bar. There was the women stayed in one residence halls, the men stayed in another. There was no drinking and swearing on campus. It was a church school, and there's only 1,000 people there. I didn't want anybody that's like, well, I'm coming here. Why didn't you tell me there was no bar? Why didn't you tell me there was no women on campus there or over there? Then they would be angry, upset. They would come for a year and then they would be gone, right? So recruit on the front end. Let me show what that means from an organizational point of view. Hey, I want you to come into my organization, but here's the deal. Your budget is only this much. If you want more budget, you have to go find it over yourself. We've also got some high union challenges that we've got to deal with. It's going to take 3 to 5 years to sort out these union challenges. Here's the path and the roadway that what that means like, right? This is what we need you to do. And there's some really heavy lifting. I imagine you're going to have to put in 8 to 12 hour days for the first year and a half. But at the end of that window, I think I can get you here. And here's what it's going to mean for you as a leader and for the organization. Do you want to come? Yeah, or hell no, right? But when you recruit on the front end like that, then you've got people who have the mindset, who have the buy-in, who want the challenge. You have to cast a wider net to get those kinds of people, but you will find you will engender more trust and loyalty.
Now, when you talk about that, it kind of tells me also, every time I set clear expectations with people, no matter professionally or personally, and I'm true to myself and I share things as they are, I feel my self-confidence is growing as well.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's any studies or anything that kind of proves that, but when you keep your word, when you act with integrity, when you set clear expectations, even if it's not what people want to hear, your confidence is growing. You're like, you know, I'm, you know.
What you've done is you've just touched on this thing called engendering trust. And when people feel heard, they feel like they matter and they belong. And those three things are all linked to confidence. They're also linked to high performance and grit, resilience, hope, and optimism. Engendering trust and letting people feel like they're heard. It doesn't mean doing what people need, but hearing people means you've considered them. You've allowed their voice to be expressed and you've given it meaningful consideration, which is different than, yeah, tell me, yeah, I don't care what's going on. And you're laying back, you're just doing it for tokenism. Well, you know what? I hear what you're saying. I can't do everything, but I can do this part of it, right? This piece I can move. And that helps.
Yeah, another thing that comes to mind now is the, I've had cases in the past, and we all do hiring mistakes, you know, people who do not necessarily fit the culture, great people, often, not always, often great people. But if I dig deeper and reflect, I would often find that they would somehow or another will struggle with self-confidence or they'll have some insecurities, self-doubts, and that will be on their way to be a great employee, a great manager, a high performer. Do you also discover the same, that the correlation between lack of self-confidence, self-esteem, and inability to perform at their best?
Yeah, for sure. You know, and the thing is, it's a couple of things. Sometimes we've put them in a position of leadership too soon. And that affects their fear of failure, right? They're like, oh my God, right? And so we don't have them aligned where their talents are. And we call that talent for the task, right? They've done really well. And so we've elevated them, and we've elevated them too quickly into an organization without putting in the right scaffolds and supports and systems that they need. Sometimes though, high performers too, what happens to them is they have this thing called perfectionism. Everything needs to be perfect. Everything needs to be perfect because they've only had success. And the higher they go, you know, you can't be perfect. In the world of sports psychology, we call it maladaptive perfectionism. When being perfect leads to poor behaviors, leads to freezing, leads to mistakes. And we have to encourage people to let go of being perfect, right? You know, from good to great, but the enemy of great is trying to be perfect. You know, there's no book called Being Perfect. There's books about excellence. There's books about being good to great. But how you define that doesn't mean you're 100% right all the time. And so we have to let go of that, especially in young leaders, if we want to grow their confidence. And we've got to stop the negative talk. We've got to stop all that. And then remind them of how great they are. Remind them of what got them there.
I wonder, because you're into soccer and you're following the global soccer events, football events. What's your take on Cristiano Ronaldo's, you know, last season, this year, his behavior? Would you acquire this to just what you described? Or like, how would you explain his behavior this year? Of course, he's one of the greatest, if not the greatest of all time to many. Yeah. How do you explain his behavior?
Well, I'll say this, as a coach of a national team, I'll always remind you that what we see on the outside is not always what's happening on the inside, right? And so what's being portrayed, we're only maybe a third of it, And I've been here where you've had a former all-star, a superstar, and may not be where they need to be, and they're falling off, right? And so what's happening with Cristiano is, I'm wondering, and you saw the difference when he was benched in Portugal and the guy came on and just boom, boom, boom. Cristiano's identity has always been, he's the man. He is the guy, right? Look, he's handsome. He's chiseled. He's a global icon. But he's in the twilight of his career. And is there a different role for him to play? And is there a different role for him to accept? So a coach might be saying, here's where we are right now. Here's how we want to use you. Christian's identity, I'm the stud. I'm the star. I go on a team and I'm the man. And the Portugal coach took a big risk in saying no. And it paid off for them. So you're what I'm left to wonder, right? We all become, you know, twilight stars. We don't burn bright forever. And how we shift into that next career and that next transition really determines, how do we go gently into that good night, or do we burn and just fade away and our legacy is destroyed? I don't know where Cristiano is going to end up, but I know he's not done being the man. Because he said, I'm going to go and remove myself from here and find the team where I can be the man. And that's okay. But you should do that with grace and dignity and not burn the bridges behind you.
Yeah. And I wonder, like, because people at this level of competitiveness, I don't know, I probably put him in the Michael Jordan competitiveness kind of level. They both, you know, some of the greatest. I would say probably the greatest of and some people will say Messi, but again, but the thing is also, and we have a lot of these people also in business who are exceptional achievers, often actually great managers as well, but they are so competitive, and that could also have the, you know, backfire with you know, I don't know what was in the team of Manchester United this season, for example, but you can see that when Cristiano left, actually they're playing much better.
Yeah.
Much better, because of the whole situation and everything. So I wonder, how do we deal with the, as managers, as leaders, with the hyperachievers, the ultra competitive achievers that want to win it all?
Yeah. So I'll say this, right? Let's not mistake the difference between the hyperachiever who's excellent and the toxic achiever who puts themselves above the team. We want competitive high achievers, but we want them because they'll bring everybody with them. We want them because they're leaderful. We want them because they raise the level of the organization. Toxic high performers, it's about their stats. It's about their numbers. You know, you've got them in sales. Like, oh, I want to close the deal, right? Those are detrimental. And I will tell you that if you remove them from an organization, every time the organization will rise. Because what happens is, people, you're limiting some of your other people. And so you can fill that gap. I know people are afraid to. I let once, as a soccer coach, let go of my very best player, leading goal scorer from Valencia, Spain, the most talented player. Yes, the very next year we dipped, but then we became national champions, right? And I say this because we're afraid about the numbers and the stats, but we don't understand what that's doing to our culture of cohesion that we just talked about, our culture of teamwork. Somebody will always rise to fill that gap. But we as leaders have to let go of the fear.
I love that you mentioned also this study previously in the conversation about how coming together, you know, having laughs, respecting each other, building this trust in a very, many times in the casual, you know, the coffee shop, the coffee machine, goes. It's good to have data around that, right? We always look into the hard kind of things. But I also wonder, because I had the exceptional founder. There's a company called Typeform. They're close to a unicorn company, 500 people. They built it from scratch. Two designers. The product was amazing. So they started growing. What the founder shared with me is, we didn't not really know how to manage people. So we were two great designers with a lot of ideas, but then we had to hire, and they wanted to create a culture of belonging. Mm-hmm. What he shared and reflected is, they actually did the opposite. They ended up creating a culture of entitlement where it's about me. The intention was the opposite, but
because of the structure, the way things were growing, they actually ended up at the end creating this culture where everybody, like, it's too loose. It's too, there's no ownership, there's no accountability. And that's probably the most asked question I get from founders and from business leaders. How do I create a culture of ownership where people are taking accountability, taking ownership, being the captain of their own ships and their responsibilities?
Yeah.
What do we do as leaders to inspire a culture of ownership and accountability?
You know, there's a book by that's called Tools for Team Excellence. And the author's name is Husco, H-U-S-C-Z-O. And he talks about clear and enticing roles and responsibilities. He talks about clear goals, right? He talks about achievements and recognitions. And he talks about performative measures, right? And so one of the things that we don't do enough of is say, here are the goals and expectations, right? Here are the goals and expectations per quarter, per year, or per fiscal period. And we put and assign numbers to that, and we put and assign qualitative features to that. So here's an example. We want to achieve accountability. Well, what's are we measuring, right? You, like, you, accountability for what? We're going to measure this. So we're going to have a clear, smart goal that says we are going to grow our performance by 10% this quarter, right? Measure What Matters, another book by John Doerr. Okay, now, who is in charge of that? You have to put somebody in charge of that goal. Boom, you're in charge of that goal. Okay, bring me a plan by this date. It's not enough to have a goal. You now need to have a plan. What's the plan? Let me put it in easy terms. If somebody's saying, I have a goal to lose 20 pounds, right, by this weight, by this period, or I have a goal to grow my business by 50% over this fiscal. Boom. Okay, what's the plan? I'm going to eat less vegetables. I'm going to drink more water. I'm going to exercise 10. You know what? I'm going to visit 50 clients. I'm going to close 3 deals, whatever that plan is. Now that you've got the goal and you've got the plan, who's your team? My team is made up of 7 people, right? We know that teams beyond 7 people become harder to manage. So I got 7 direct reports that are going to be in charge of, that are going to help me achieve that. And they must now have clear, enticing roles and responsibilities, clear, smart goals and check-ins. If we don't do that, right? If we don't do that, then we just allow the ship to go wherever it wants. And sometimes we wait till the end of the year to give people feedback. No. Early and frequent feedback allows and ensures that we're on the right path to achieving our goal.
Again, everybody's looking for the magic pill, right?
Yeah.
And the more I have conversations with experienced experts like yourself, with business leaders, executives, the peak performing, the ones that are achieving the most, that have the most excited and engaged teams, it's the same stuff. Right? Like it's simple. Yeah. Hey, clear, defined purpose. Where are we going? How are we doing it? Plans, you know, time management. How do we do things? What are the KPIs? How do we measure roles and responsibilities? Bringing people that are excited and engaged, getting them to do things, not just that they're good at, but things that they love to do. They're passionate about things that they want to develop in. Creating this kind of structure and doing it on a consistent basis, putting in things into the culture every single day, showing up, feedback. I mean, it's not rocket science.
Yeah.
It's not rocket science. I wonder, Ivan, you are very focused on being a professional speaker, doing more than 60 speeches per year, but you also do training. Mm-hmm. And you talk to a lot of business leaders. What are some of the top challenges that they share with you when you have one-on-one conversations, maybe something that, what are the top challenges that you hear these days?
You know, it's interesting. The pandemic has changed the response to that question, you know, bringing people back to the workforce in person, creating a team where people are like connected to each other, burnout, optimism, right? Hope. Folks are tired, you know, they're facing rejection. They're living in isolation. Right? How do we bring that back together? How do we increase retention? Everybody's looking to jump, right? You don't have employees staying 15, 20 years anymore. How do we keep our employees? How do we keep them happy? Those are the consistent messages I'm being called upon by banks and pharmaceutical companies and hospitals and business leaders, insurance companies, is like, help us. And I wish, to your point, that Stoyan, I wish there was a magic button. There isn't. But it does speak to the culture that we're trying to create in our workplace.
Yeah, and it starts with the leadership.
Yes.
Not only coming up with these strategies, but actually owning it and being the example. And it's a cliche, lead by example.
Yeah.
The problem is not many of us do it consistently.
Yeah.
It's not that we don't know what we want to do. You can find the tools. You can find the strategies. You can find there's millions of, you can get a coach, consultant, read the 20 books. You get the tools, but are you willing to do the hard things?
Yeah.
Are you willing to be persistent and consistent in this?
Yeah.
Ivan, since there's many actually consultants, coaches, authors listening to the podcast, and they might be interested to hear a little bit about your speaking journey. By the way, everybody listening, if you're looking for a kick-ass speaker, this is your guy, Dr. Ivan Joseph. Go check out his TEDx talk. Even though it's from 10 years ago, I'm sure he's 10 times better now. And inspiring, straight to the point, scientifically based, exceptional storyteller. So you got to check out this gentleman here. He's doing many, many speeches in some of the top organizations, probably overbooked, but still, you know, maybe you can get a shot and get him in 2024. I don't know. But I just wonder, Ivan, what was the game changer for you? I mean, you've been working with sports teams, you've been, you know, universities, but you grew a career as a professional speaker, really one of the top speakers out there. And was that writing the book? Was it the TEDx talk? Was it the way you present and you started to get more engagements? What made a difference for you in your career as a speaker?
You know, my story as a speaker was one by accident. I didn't even know this career existed, you know. And I just did a sports psychology lecture for some students at my university. He said, can you be part of this TED thing? I didn't even know what it was back then. I'm like, I was an athletic director. But I knew that my president was speaking and my provost was speaking. So I wanted to do a really good job. So I took an hour-long talk that I used to do. And I said, here are the 13 most important things, like I can put it. I put it in 13 minutes. And when it hit a million, a speaker spotlight and another National Speakers Bureau called me, both within the same week, and said, hey, would you like to come speak for us? How much do you charge? And I'm like, what? You're going to pay me? And I'm like, $500, $500. And they laughed at me. They're like, oh, my God. They're like, are you crazy? We want to pay you way more. Add another zero to that. I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? What? No way. I'm used to getting paid with a bottle of wine or like a thank you card. And so, long story short, that talk, when it hit a million views, boom. And I got up there and all of a sudden I started making, you know, 10 speeches a year. I'm like, whoa, this is free money. $40,000. This is nice. And I'm like, you know, I think something could happen. And I do one and somebody else would hear it. And I wasn't doing any advertising or any websites or anything. And then somebody just said, we think you should write a book about this topic. And then I wrote a book and all of a sudden I went to 30 speeches a year. Right? I was like, whoa, this is really good. And then somebody said, we think you need a website. You need an Instagram and Twitter account. I'm like, what? And so I just did that last year. And all of a sudden, 60 speeches a year. I'm like, whoa. Right? So I'm like, I still have a real job. Like, I'm a vice president. I got 400 people that report to me. But on the side of my desk, it's like, should I try this full time? But again, my confidence is like, I don't know. I'm just a little scared. Right? So we all have it. Just because you have confidence in one area, I'm a great speaker, doesn't mean you have a confidence in the other area. I can do this full time and be a business magnet. No, it's going to take me a little while to get there.
It's funny how you kind of accidentally grew this profile as a top speaker. Imagine if you actually put yourself out there, like with, you know, going to the top podcasts, creating a lot of content out there. Like, I mean, you're going to explode, Ivan, with your energy, with your message. You're going to be just, I can't even imagine. I'm cheering for you and then looking forward to a lot more from you. I think the world needs to hear more from you, Ivan.
Thank you. You're very kind, my friend.
So hopefully we get, but I'm curious, like you spoke at the TEDx, right? Like students, maybe 500 people. I don't know how big was
the 200 people. 200 people.
Yeah. You know, at some point you start getting this, I don't know,
5K, 10K audience. Yeah. Like, talk to me about the inner journey. Like, was it scary for you that it's a bigger audience? And how did you get over the fear of speaking in front of bigger audiences?
You know, if you go on YouTube, you'll see my very first speech out there. It's Women's Food Service Forum. And I remember because Maya Angelou was also on there and Soledad O'Brien. Yeah. And you'll see me go on the stage and I make this joke. It's like, whew, I'm a little tired after just running up the stairs. I wasn't tired. There were no stairs. My heart was racing so fast, I couldn't speak. So I had to give myself a little time to use my own skills on myself. Slow down, Ivan. You got this. You can do this. There was 4,000, 5,000 people in that auditorium. And I was like, holy sugar. Wow. And I was like, okay. Right. And I was just like nervous Nelly. But that one that I got the first standing ovation, and it's like, oh my gosh, it just filled me up. And from there, that first paid speech, I got 10 from that because there was Coca-Cola was there, McDonald's was there, like all these major food service industries, Burger King, like all these people. And all of a sudden, like, what? You want me to do the same speech over here? The same speech over here? The same speech. Yeah, I'll do it. Yeah, absolutely. And so I started doing the same speech. Okay, boom, 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 boom. And when I did it, it was like, well, this is easy. But I only had one speech. And I'm like, okay, I need to do more. So then I developed another speech. I'm like, okay. Then all of a sudden people are like, okay, now he's speaking about high performance. He's like, okay. And I was like, you know what? I think, you know what? After George Floyd, diversity, equity, and inclusion, I want to do about what it's like to be a Black man and lead and how we can create a more inclusive culture because that leads to business excellence. So I did another speech. And so every time I add a speech, I get a 30% bump in the number of bookings I get.
I think that's the most beautiful thing about this industry is if you're good, if you prepare, if you go out there, the more you speak, the more you get the opportunities as well.
Yeah. Yeah. If you do a good job, people want a good job. And so the word of mouth, you know, somebody will hear me there, they'll change companies, then they'll bring me there. Right. Oh yeah. I heard you when you were there. I'm not working here. Can you come and do this? I'm like, yeah, absolutely.
And Ivan, what are you excited about? What are you passionate about at this stage? You've achieved so much in many different areas, and I would imagine opportunities. Some people don't realize the more you achieve, it comes the problem of what should I pick? What direction should I focus on? Yeah. Because there's so many opportunities. What's on the table? What's on your heart? What's in your mind these days?
You know, well, you know what? I want to make confidence more accessible to everybody, right? You know, 5 years ago, I built a course and it was like $400 and it came with coaching and this and that. And I got lots of folks and I made lots of money from it. But you know what? I think my next thing is to make confidence more accessible. I'm going to take that $400 course and in the first of Black History Month, pay attention for your folks out there. I'm going to make it something like $9 or 99 cents. I don't know. I haven't decided yet, but I'm going to make the price so cheap that it's like, oh, of course, because I want people to understand. I don't want finances to be a barrier for them doing this, right? And maybe I'm going to make it 99 cents or a dollar or something like that. And I want them to take that and realize how much it will change the way they lead and the way they perform in their workplace. I want my message now to be for everybody and I want it to spread.
I'm getting goosebumps, and Ivan, just let us know how we can support you to spread this message. What a beautiful vision. Imagine living in a world where the vast majority of people are self-confident.
Yeah, where they believe in themselves and they don't let people take them away from their dreams, their hopes, and their aspirations, right? That's what it is. Because lots of people have magical, great ideas that never get to the table because somebody told us we weren't good enough.
I love it. Ivan, we're getting close to the end of this episode, and I just want to wrap up, maybe finish up with a question about, there's many people, probably even many of them listening right now, who in one shape or another are struggling with self-esteem, mm-hmm. self-confidence, feeling not good enough. What would be your message to these people out there, like a final message?
I want them to recognize that when you feel that self-doubt, when you feel like you're not good enough, you're not alone. everybody's feeling that. I'm a vice president that makes lots of money, that lives in a fancy house and this, and you look at them and you think they have it made. We all feel the same way. And so a couple of things I want to remind you of. When you're feeling like that, remind yourself what you tell yourself you become. Stop that negative talk and try and replace it with an affirmation. Write yourself a letter, a personal brag sheet, a thing about all the things you're good at. Pull it out and read it to yourself over and over and over again. If there's negative and critical people around you that are just telling you you're no good, stop and get away from those people. Limit your interaction with those people. Allow them to just pass one ear and out the next. And then the last and most important thing is believe in yourself. Because when you do, the rest of the world will too. It's not going to happen overnight. But when you start telling and reminding yourself of your greatness, watch what you'll achieve. Confidence is a skill, and a skill requires day-to-day attention and practice. Believe in yourself, folks, and the rest of the world will too.
What a beautiful way to end this episode. And just for those listening who would be interested to get more of Dr. Ivan Joseph, where could people find you, learn more about what you do?
Yeah.
You know, first of all, everybody needs to go and get a copy of this book. You got this, the Mastering the Skill of Self-Confidence. I got it on a Kindle. There's a paper version. It's a beautiful book. Even if you came across the concepts, the way they're presented, they really inspire you to take action. I've already noted a few things I need to do these days to move on with my own things. But it's a beautiful book with a lot of stories, examples. I'm a data guy. I love that there's a lot of also studies to support all these kind of beautiful practices. So go check out the book for sure. You Got This by Dr. Ivan Joseph. Where else could people find you, connect with you, and learn from you?
You know, reach out to me. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. My website, www.drivan@drivanjoseph.com, right? www.ivan@drivanjoseph.com. You can sign up for a newsletter. You can sign up for Goalie Tip Sheet. Like, there's a whole bunch of free resources on there. I'm happy to share them with you folks. All right.
Thank you so much for everybody for listening. You Got This. And if there is an event producer, if there is anybody who's putting up an event and wants to get a kick-ass people to leave your audience with an all, you know who to call. Dr. Ivan Joseph. You can find him on LinkedIn. You can find him on his webpage. Make sure to get in touch. Thanks once again for listening, and see you once again the next episode of Productivity Mastery. Be cool. Thank you guys for listening. Make sure to subscribe to my monthly newsletter by visiting stoyanyankov.com, and also learn about the Perform methodology and the Perform book, as well as our various personal and team coaching offers. Stay tuned and keep performing.